This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack
and Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, we tell you why one of the biggest cable companies is selling its entertainment business.
Plus, at the same time, we tell you why Amazon is getting into the entertainment business with a $9 billion offer.
Also on the show, how Google Canada is spending millions to train job seekers.
And everything you need to know about new rules for Twitter verification.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
Trending up.
So much news and so little time, but the sun is out. People are enjoying it. Amber, how was your week?
Well, I think you're right because honestly, when the weather is nicer, I think it makes this whole eternal lockdown experience somewhat better. So it's been beautiful. You know, it feels as though things are getting better every week. And I am cautiously optimistic about the future. So that's probably a different viewpoint than some of our past episodes of the show.
Certainly is. And we're seeing numbers increase of people being vaccinated. So obviously we're in Toronto, been in lockdown since September, October last year. But the light at the end of the tunnel. But let's get right to it. What are people talking about?
Well, there's a lot of news in the big tech world, as well as from telcos in the U.S. AT&T has announced that they're selling off their entertainment business to drill back down to the basics. Their focus will be, unsurprisingly, like many of the telcos across North America and beyond, on 5G. So this is a bit of big news in the entertainment space. What they would be unloading is Warner Media. This is a pretty significant asset that they have. And apparently they're selling it, I think, Michael, to Discovery for about $43 billion. So not a small bit of money.
It's not jump change. But what is interesting, though, you have to remember all of those headlines, you know, 3-4 years ago when they were fighting like crazy to actually acquire the asset. So it is interesting in whatever's happened in the last 3 or 4 years to have them, you know, an about face on what their goals and mission is now for the future and the direction of the company. Because, you know, that is quite a large price tag. It's quite a large asset. So it will be interesting to see what Discovery does with it as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. And just sticking with the theme in terms of big tech companies and telcos and entertainment businesses, at the same time, according to Vanity Fair, Amazon is in talks to acquire MGM Studios for $9 billion. This is just on the heels of that Warner Media and Discovery announcement. So clearly, Amazon is getting its hands into yet another business. And this could be really interesting. I mean, it's amazing just to think of the range of assets that Amazon has under its wing today. I've talked about this a lot, and we had a guest on, Michael, I believe it was last week, who has written a book on Amazon and talked about how they've been able to reach into everything from e-commerce to owning a newspaper, and the list of things that they own goes on, exploring space. there's no end to what they are interested in doing.
It does make sense just if you look at the content space and what they offer in regards to that medium, almost trying to close the loop or try and get at scale the ability to create, make, and deliver the content. And obviously, if you're able to own the entire loop, it's a lot better from a market share perspective and controlling from a pricing and cost perspective and all of those things. So from a business perspective, I understand why it's good. But then I also just worry, you know, as we've seen, and we see companies having monopolies in all kinds of industries, what that means to the end consumer. So obviously, that worries me a little.
Yeah, you know, and if you think about Amazon as one example of that, it's not their first foray into entertainment, of course. They are the creators of Amazon Prime, which, according to Vanity Fair, has more than 200 million subscribers worldwide. So they definitely have a lot going on in terms of these different pillars of their business. And I think more and more it makes it difficult for some of the smaller players to really compete, right? And that's just a reality, whether we're talking about small merchants or small media companies. I mean, it's getting more difficult with these big tech players who really dominate on all fronts in so many different sectors.
And it is interesting because obviously, as you said, they have that streaming service. And then when you look at legacy media companies, they're trying to actually grow and compete with streaming services. And, you know, they're not doing as well at all compared to, you know, the likes of Netflix and Amazon. So it's going to be fascinating to see. Again, as I just worry, and I know people notice the difference when, you know, even slight increases of $2 a month to your Netflix subscription or whatever it is, or in this case, Amazon Prime, it does make a huge difference over the year. And then we're starting to see prices and payments of what we were all complaining about before when we were paying for cable. So it's just fascinating. It's almost like we're going to becoming full circle, but in this case we're going to be subscribing to a gazillion services and it's just all going to add up.
Yeah, it's true. You know, just this weekend I spent, I want to say 3 or 4 hours. And what I did is I went through my Android phone into the Google Play store and I checked out all of the digital subscriptions that I had up and running. I do this fairly regularly, so there weren't too many. But then I also went into my credit card payments and saw all these services that I had subscribed to, some of them from years ago that I really wasn't using. And it is just a reminder that probably every 3 months, the average person would benefit from doing just that, because I suspect that I probably saved myself $1,500 a year just from canceling some services that I didn't use or downgrading services, right? I would get pro accounts to things like LinkedIn that I never, ever used. And in that case, you know, that's hundreds of dollars a year.
It certainly does add up. Well, our last story we wanted to look at was there's lots and lots of news out of Google's I/O developer conference.
Yeah, this is a big one. So a couple of things that were announced, and Mashable has a really great write-up of some of the updates. There were updates to Password Manager, new safety and privacy features, which is always a good thing, some AI advancements, some Google Maps updates. Should also mention that they also announced a partnership with Shopify. So everybody will know Shopify is the company that makes it possible for individual merchants to go online. They have more than 1 million merchants who use their software and services. And now they've partnered with Google. So that would make it easier for some of those merchants to be easily found within Google searches and services on a regular basis. So again, kind of all roads lead back to Amazon. It's an opportunity again to compete with a big player like them who really dominate when it comes to e-commerce.
I was going to say that is a fascinating move by Google to partner with Shopify, because Shopify already had penetrated the market so enormously, and it was almost like that underdog everyone was kind of rooting for compared to Amazon. And then for the likes of Google to say, oh, well, if we partner with you guys, maybe we can take on Amazon. So very interesting indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be definitely one to watch, see how they further roll out that partnership. But I think it's a great thing. I mean, if you think about how many of the entrepreneurs exist on Shopify, at the end of the day, I think if there's a way for them to be discovered in an easier way, that can be beneficial for so many of those millions of small businesses that are part of the Shopify ecosystem.
Well, stay with us. When we return, we're going to continue our discussion on Google. We're going to talk about how Google is giving Canadians new opportunities for digital skills.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
We have talked a lot on this show about the changing job landscape and how advances in technology and innovation have actually created new employment opportunities. Well, to help job seekers in their efforts to ensure they are prepared for their future careers, Google Canada is committing $2 million to help train job seekers. To share more, Sabrina Jeremiah is the VP and Country Manager of Google Canada and is joining us now. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, this is an exceptionally important initiative. Can you tell us about why Google Canada decided to make this move?
Well, thanks so much. I'm happy to be here and I'm really excited about this. So we know that in the past year that a lot of Canadians have lost their jobs and a lot of folks are just looking to retrain and reskill. And we know how important digital skills are for the future economy. And so we really want to bring Canadians along with us with all of the digitization that is happening. So that is why we've made this commitment for $2 million to reskill these job seekers in Canada that can lead to new, really good careers in technology in less than 6 months. And so we are introducing 4 career certificates, and you can find them by Googling Grow with Google. And these are skills in areas like UX design, data analytics. There's a really interesting one on coding in Python or even project management. And we know that there are 22,000 open jobs in these fields, and these are transferable, learnable skills that folks can learn and be eligible for these roles in less than 6 months.
So when you talk about that investment as far as the $2 million to train job seekers, how is that money divided and where does that support go?
So the certificates are available to anybody, and you can find them on Grow with Google. They're offered in partnership with Coursera. But the $2 million commitment is actually for 5,000 scholarships that we're deploying through NPower and other nonprofits. And the target here is really underrepresented youth in Canada who we really think would benefit from these skills and find great careers and great jobs that they love. And, you know, I can say that because I've met some of the folks that graduated from our first certificate, which was in IT, IT certificate. And they were so excited about the learning opportunity they had, the jobs that they landed. One of the people went from the food industry and is now working in technology at Touch Bistro.
This is usually a very male-dominated area of where people work. So how are you going about trying to attract a more diverse pool of talent to get upskilled and join the workforce in these technology jobs?
Yeah, this is a great question. I mean, I think that digital skills and the digital and technology industry are for everyone. And, you know, I say that as someone who works in it as, you know, a female, and I see this opportunity. And that is why these 5,000 scholarships are really looking to target underrepresented youth in this area. But I think it's really important to say that a lot of the folks that I've spoken to who have done, you know, the IT certificate, which is the one that 50,000 people have done so far, and it's been live for a couple of years. You know, one example is a woman out west who actually trained for it with a newborn in her house and was, you know, doing this work while the baby was napping and now is in a job that she really loves in this field. And I think it's that idea that you can actually build these skills in, you know, bite-sized chunk. It's 5 to 10 hours per week while you're doing other things, even while you're currently employed. And it can lead to new options further down the line. And I just want to make it really clear that you don't need experience in technology to take these certificates and that they are for everybody.
It feels to me like this is the future of learning because as someone who has watched the evolution of the digital industry over 2 decades now, it's fascinating to me how quickly things change, whether you're talking about a programming language or what skills are necessary to develop on the internet, whatever that might be, it's in a constant state of change. It's hard for large institutions to keep up. When you think about the future of learning, do you think this sort of, you know, short span of being able to get certificates is going to become more the norm and make it more accessible for the average person?
Yeah, Amber, I think that's a really great point. Look, I think with digital and technology, it is constantly evolving. So you always have to learn with it. And I say this, you know, as someone who works for Google in a fairly senior position, and I have to recertify and redo certificates, micro certificates and micro training myself every 3 months. So I think it's par for the course. And so it is really difficult to just think that you're going to go and get one education like maybe you did 20 years ago, and that would serve you in the learning on the ground. This idea of constantly building your skills and having the mindset of a continuous learner is critical. And I think these micro certificates are one component that can help you build really high demand digital skills. Again, 22,000 jobs in Canada open today in the skills just on these 5 certificates that we've launched. And you can build these and attach them. And I see learning as like building blocks, almost like Lego blocks. And it's one fantastic block to add onto the skills that you have that can actually open up new job opportunities.
Speaking of change, it's really interesting and really good to see that large corporations are working in partnership for this greater purpose of upskilling and training the workforce. Can you talk a little bit about the employer consortium? Because Google is, you know, alongside large corporations and big names that you would think are maybe even competing in them in some instances, depending on the different verticals. And we're talking about KPMG and TELUS and Loblaws.
Yeah, I think that's a really good opportunity here is that all of these companies are looking to hire digital talent in these areas. And so what we have as part of this program is an employer consortium where any company in Canada could actually join. And I'd really invite them to go to Grow with Google. And there is a place where you can sign up. And what we do is we get the names and the CVs of the graduates from these certificates in the hands of the employers who are in this consortium, so that they can evaluate them and see if there's a fit. And I think that's what's so important about trying to do this. It's not just about skills, it's about jobs. And in the IT certificate program, which was almost like a pilot, what we saw was that 83% of the folks that went through and graduated landed in either a job that they love or a new education programs 5 months after the program. And I think these connections to that last mile of helping them is important. And I also want to just underline the importance of our partners and our nonprofit partners like NPower. They will give advice on resume building, how to interview, how to kind of, you know, clean up your LinkedIn profile to really help make folks, put them in the best position to get a job.
Well, listen, we hope that people listening will for sure check this out. A reminder to everybody again, all you have to do is head on over to grow.google. Sabrina, thank you so much for being with us and thanks for sharing more about this program.
Thank you.
Up next, where you can go to sell your old electronics with backflips.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Aptastic.
Welcome back to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. It's time now to take a look at new and trending apps. If you listen to The Feed on a regular basis, and we hope that you do, you know that this is the segment where I tease Michael about the fact that many of the apps give me an indication of the kind of week that he's had. And based on looking at this, he's thinking about the environment. He's feeling a little bit stressed and he's not working out enough.
Yes. And even on top of that, I went to try and find a cord last night and lost my mind because I found 20 devices in the last 10 years that were in a box. And I was like, what am I doing? So yes, it's a yes, check, check, and check for these three apps of the day in the life of Michael B.
Yeah, wow. Okay, the first one we're going to talk about is Backflip. Now, I have to tell you that this is a San Francisco-based company. So if you're listening in an area where maybe Backflip doesn't work, there are other options when you search to recycle your electronics. But Michael, let's talk about Backflip because it seems like they make it really simple to sell your old electronics.
Yeah, it's really easy. It's three simple steps. You get an instant offer to it. You get ship free and boxless and then get paid within 24 hours. That's the simplistic three-step process. And you can check it out at backflip.com. And of course, then it runs through with you exactly, you know, if you have any like further questions. But that's basically it in a nutshell.
Yeah. And even the, we're talking about it being an app, but I'll be honest with you, even backflip.com, one of the things that's really cool. So let's say you don't have Backflip in your area. I would recommend going to backflip.com and checking out their sell my phone section or any other section, because they do give you a range and it's a really beautifully designed website in terms of the going price for things like a new iPhone, like an Apple iPhone 12 Pro Max, what that would go for and kind of the range and all of the details, depending on the storage and any other specifications of the device. So it's a good starting point in terms of understanding a little bit better what the value might be to a device that you have on hand.
And speaking of the actual price, on average, it's about 50% higher than competitive services, they say. And your price is guaranteed, or they will actually return your device for free. So there's no worry if it doesn't seem to work out or it's not agreeable to you through the process. So I like that that's built in. So there's really no stress and worry. But the main thing is that you're doing the right thing and helping the environment. This next one we wanted to talk about, this works for people that need a little mindfulness in their life, but also very good for parents. And so it's called Mama Zen. It's an award-winning, I just love the name, sorry, Mama Zen. is an award-winning mindfulness and positive parenting app for moms. Now, I'm not a mom, but there is a lot of stuff in this app that I found really useful this week. And then it actually started making me think about having kids and how would you manage it? And I mean, it's a lot of work. So I think anything that can help you becoming a calm parent and a calm person is good in my books.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I'm sure that our listeners feel this as well. Once we sort of move into a place where it's safer to be able to go out and we get out of lockdown and the restrictions lift, I really do believe that we're going to have a mental health crisis because after 14 months or more of people being stuck indoors, not seeing people, trying to just kind of, you know, stay all tightened up and together and focused and everything, when things loosen up, I think there's going to be a real...
like a free-for-all?
Yeah. And I think that we'll see, unfortunately, the effects of the mental health crisis that has only been accelerating during COVID-19. And so I love that there's apps like this, and I encourage people to check them out, because even with Mama Zen, one of the things I love is that they have a 7-minute emergency session. So if you're feeling like you're really overwhelmed and stressed, which is something all of us feel time and time again, then you can sit for 7 minutes and go through some of those meditation exercises. So it's just a really good idea to start taking mental health more seriously. And I hope that we get to the point where there's less stigma around that.
And also remember, obviously, parenting is a two-way street with your, if you have a partner and you're parenting two people, there's a dad zone, there's a couple zone, there's sessions that can help, you know, if you're looking to grow with your husband, partner, boyfriend, whoever it is, significant other, it focuses on that. And what they do say is, of course, if you're calmer, then of course you're going to raise and have happier kids, and they'll grow up to be the same. So I think it's really important to, you know, if you're overwhelmed, if you feel anxious, there's nothing wrong with that. We all do. Take the time out, use these sessions. They're great. They take you through, as Amber said, short, if you only have a short amount of time, they've got sessions for that. But if you need longer time, which I did this week, that, you know, they've got that there as well. So it's called Mama Zen, and I believe you'll be Zen in no time.
Very cool. Okay. I have to say that I love this last app, but I'm sad that it's not available for Android. It's only available for iOS devices, but that's good news for iPhone owners right now. It's called Times 100. And what a great idea. I'm surprised no one has thought of this before now.
So you know how I would have said that, right? I would have said X100, and then you would have been like, what's wrong with you?
Hey, you can still say X100, but it's cool. Say it however you want.
You know
but
me.
It is an X. To be fair. And it helps you to count reps while you're working out. So, you know, now that we're all working out at home, it's more difficult to keep track of those workouts. So you turn on the camera and it will keep track of your reps doing, as you're doing weight training, for example, you can set a goal. And then using the camera in the iPhone, it essentially tracks to make sure that you've reached that goal. So very cool use of technology.
Yeah, the only thing I will say is, and this is probably music to everybody's ears, it finds it difficult counting burpees. Nobody likes burpees. So
you
this
just
is a
didn't,
good thing.
Don't do them then.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Don't do them. But it can easily count simple repetitive movements like push-ups and squats and all those kinds of things, which everybody should be doing anyway. They've got the counter, the timer, all kinds of stuff. You can track your stats. So it's really good because I don't know if you find this, Amber, but I'm concentrating and I'm, you know, if I'm doing push-ups and I get to like 14 or 15 and then I do think of something else and then I forget and then I'm like, wait, does that count? Where am I at? Should I start again? Like it's you do get sidetracked.
Yeah. And little tip, because I actually used to like burpees when I was doing more strength training at the gym. I don't like them anymore, but I started doing reverse burpees. So that's a little bit easier. Do you know what they are,
Michael? So you mean you start with your legs out and then go up as opposed to start up.
It's totally different. So a burpee, you jump up, then you put your hands to the ground, you jump out like a push-up, jump in and jump back up. A reverse burpee, what you do is you bend down and then you roll on your bum and your back and you kind of touch your feet to the floor. Then you roll back up and you jump. So you're going backwards.
I think I might like that better.
It's a reverse burpee. It's just easier than a regular burpee, but it still gets your heart rate up. So it's a good sort of interim solution.
It sounds like I'd be clumsy doing that though, because you said go backwards, and I'm like,
You're just like, you got to be on a mat or carpet, but you're just rolling backwards. And I only mention it because it's just easier, right? Because you're bending down, you're kind of like rolling on your bum, rolling, and then you come forward, and then you stand up and jump. So a little bit easier.
Any movement is good movement. So those three apps we had was Backflip, Mama's In, and X100, the way I would say it. But of course, times 100 makes way more sense. If you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at Amber Mac and at AmBancroft80 and use the hashtag The Feed. Coming up, how the public health company is helping businesses stay safe in a post-pandemic world.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. The global pandemic has brought risk detection and prevention of disease outbreaks to the forefront of everyone's minds. So the public health company is on a mission to protect businesses and communities from infectious disease by helping prevent, detect, and contain communicable diseases and the threats that they cause. So Dr. Charity Dean is the CEO and co-founder of the public health company and is joining us now. Thank you so much for being with us, Charity. Can you start with exactly what specifically does the public health company do?
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. And I would frame this as risk management of disease, not just in terms of what might be coming, but actual operational execution within a company or within an organization. It's the answer to the question, what do I need to do now to protect my organization?
It's so interesting, too, as we think about the post-pandemic recovery and more businesses that are opening up. You know, it's not just good enough anymore to run a business and think about basic HR. You also have to think about how you're going to keep people safe. Can you talk a little bit about what you anticipate over the next 6 months with more businesses getting back to some face-to-face interaction?
Definitely. What I anticipate is going to be a lot of apprehension about people coming back to the office. And I'm here in California, and I see that many offices are wanting to bring people back as vaccination rates are up and positivity rate is very low, especially in the Bay Area. However, the risk is not zero. And as we watch dangerous variants emerge around the world in places like India, and we know the whole world is not vaccinated, this pandemic is far from over, and businesses know that. And so I think the next 6 months will be looking for guidance and really operational answers to questions of how do we bring people back safely? Can we bring them back safely? And what do we do when we have cases in the workplace or when a new dangerous variant emerges?
When we think about the public health company and what you're doing with the company, could you give us an example of how you would work with a company and what specifically you would do to help them prepare and help them, you know, make sure that they're doing the right thing and keeping their staff safe?
Yeah. And I think examples are really important because they bring it down to a tactical level. My motto is tactical, practical, operational. We don't want to give them a white paper. We want to actually handle it for them, start to finish. So here's an example of what that might look like. Let's say that a large office building plans to bring people back, and the majority of them are vaccinated, and they have 1,000 workers that are going to come back into this office building sharing airspace. And the question is, not only how do we do that safely, or can we do it, but once the decision has been made to do it, what kind of surveillance testing or safety measures need to be in place so that when cases occur, they know what to do? So let's say they bring the workers back, and within the first month, they identify 10 cases of COVID spread over a 3-week period. And their question, of course, is going to be, did we do something wrong? is there a safety procedure we need in place, or was this simply a coincidence, or cases are rising in the community and we're just seeing that? In other words, they want to know, did transmission happen within our four walls? The answer to that question is a complex scientific approach called genomic epidemiology, which we, the public health company, have put into software. And the answer to the question of, did these cases transmit the infection within our four walls, is pretty simple from the company's standpoint. Collect specimens. We take care of everything else, the genomic fingerprinting, wherever it's done at our laboratory or someone else's laboratory. We compare the fingerprint of the very specific virus, and we can actually show if transmission occurred within their four walls. And then drilling down on their operations, we can actually pinpoint the place where it likely occurred. Was it a lapse in protocols they have? Is a new approach needed? For example, do they need to be doing daily surveillance testing of employees because those employees are higher risk? Maybe they interact with the public. Or if that analysis shows that actually none of those cases were related to each other based on a genomic fingerprint, then what it actually tells that company is they've done everything right. They have succeeded in safely bringing people back to work, and cases will continue to occur from time to time as a result of spillover from the community, but it was not the company's plan that was at fault.
What do you think the future of workspaces is going to be like? Is this going to be something where they need services from a company like yours for the next couple of years? Or do you think the pandemic has forever changed all of us working under one roof together inside?
I believe it has forever changed how corporations approach risk. Up to this point, it would have been very difficult for me to tell them stories and show them genomics and explain that this was an existential risk to their company. Now, after what they've experienced in COVID, what I am seeing is they inherently understand the continuity of operations risk posed by disease, and not just COVID, but the potential for other diseases. These kinds of concerns are always going on in the background for businesses, but the threat of COVID has really driven home the point that they cannot just wait to address it when the problem happens. It's critical that they have an ongoing plan, that they have expertise at their fingertips that can handle that risk for them from start to finish, so that they're able to do things in the very beginning to reduce the risk both to their continuity of operations, to the health of their employees, and to the health of the public they serve.
Well, absolutely. Well, thank you for all the work that you're doing, Dr. Dean, and wanted to encourage people to check out your company. Again, the name is The Public Health Company, and we so appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
Up next, five things you need to know about getting verified on Twitter.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Power Friend.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. If you've ever wondered what the importance is behind that little blue badge that you may see on some Twitter accounts and how those accounts got verified, we are here to have a conversation about that process and how it's changed. Joining us now is Cam Gordon, who is head of communications at Twitter Canada. Hello, Cam.
Hello, Amber. Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Now, before we get into this conversation around how verification works, what is kind of the history of verification and some of the misconceptions behind that process?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I know we're chatting a bit, you know, as we set up the interview. I've been at Twitter for about 6 years. It is far and away the number one question I've gotten during my time with the company, with the when are you getting an edit button? A distant second, although also a popular question in its own right. I mean, when verification started, it was really a tool to combat impersonation. So when you think back to the early days of Twitter, we're talking 2007, 2008, 2009, and, you know, really the early days of social media, one of the first things, you know, and this wasn't just a Twitter thing, but you get people claiming to be somebody they weren't. So when you think back to who were the notable personalities of 2007, 2008, like, you know, there were probably a lot of like fake Paris Hiltons running around the internet, or Lindsay Lohan or Kanye West or whoever the big personalities. So it's something we installed originally as something just to help combat impersonation on Twitter and obviously, you know, other platforms and other services instilled similar things. Now, in the years since, obviously, it's kind of morphed into, it means different things to different people. I mean, but, you know, it's very much also for a lot of people been tied into like celebrity and notability and all these other things. So that's really why we decided to pause it a few years ago. It's only just now we're bringing it back because we know it's such an important topic, and it's an important topic to a lot of people, important topic to us too. And we just really wanted to make sure we got it right as we brought it back.
So why is it so important, and why are you bringing it back? Because as you touched on, obviously in the early days we saw with social media on all platforms, it was more about personalities and celebrities and people impersonating them. But it seems that it's become far more valuable than ever before now, 10 plus years later, and it seems more about for everyday people ensuring against fraud and identity theft and genuinely knowing who you're following and if they're actually verified in the fact that you should be following them and it's authentic and it's quality and it's not against any of your policies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, really at the core, I mean, there are some things that haven't changed. I mean, certainly, you know, it's not just the idea that someone would be impersonating a celebrity or an athlete or a politician, but, you know, somebody who might be impersonating a police officer for a major, you know, police agency, or a journalist from a major organization, or somebody who works for a sports team. And I mean, it's interesting as years have gone by too, just what defines celebrity is very much change within our culture. If you think back to 2007, I mean, we didn't have professional esports athletes and TikTok influencers and Peloton instructors and all these other people that, you know, you could argue is they're famous, more famous than like movie stars and TV stars. So as the idea of notability has changed, I mean, that really forced us to adapt our policies for how this whole system works. And again, like we first paused our public verification portal over 3 years ago. So this bringing it back this week is really 3 years in the making, and a lot of consideration went into this. And that's why we started this process actually in publicly communicating how we wanted to approach it back in November. And we've been a bit iterative in how we brought it back with subsequent blog posts we published in, I believe it was last November and last December. And now it's finally coming back and here's the full scope, but it does tie into some of the things that we kind of crowdsourced from the people at Twitter last fall and through the winter.
So I do want to ask you how not to get verified, because I feel like you have many stories about maybe people trying some unconventional ways, but we do want to be productive on the show. So with this new structure in place, who can get verified? What is actually the proper process aside from DMing Cam Gordon?
Yeah, which I do get a lot. I'll just go through the quick laundry list of, you know, what's not going to work. I mean, certainly like tweeting at whether it's a Twitter employee or a Twitter owned and operated account like Twitter Canada or Jack Dorsey himself, that's not a path to verification. Also, I've heard references to things like crowdsourcing campaigns or referral programs. I've seen this actually just recently. I work for the company. I have no idea what those things are, so that's not really a path. A really key one too. And you know, you cannot buy verification either. I've actually gotten this question a few times over the years, and like a lot of things on the internet, sometimes there's people looking to make a buck somewhere. So certainly verification is never going to be something you can buy for sure. Now, how you can get verified. One other misconception, this ties into how you can get verified. Some people think it's strictly a measure of how many followers you have, which is definitely not true. That might be a consideration that we take into account partially, but in and of itself, having a lot of Twitter followers is not grounds for verification. So really how it works now, you have to be in one of six different categories. So a government official of some sort, a notable company, brand, organization, Third category would be someone from a news organization or a journalist. Fourth category would be somebody notable in the entertainment sphere. Fifth category would be someone notable in sports and gaming. And then last but not least, but a really important one, is activists, organizers, or influential individuals. So if you think of, you know, if you're someone who leads perhaps like a local Black Lives Matter chapter or something of this ilk, that could qualify. And then within that, our team that deals with this, and that's something really important to point out. We have a specific team that deals with verification. So it's certainly not people like myself who are in the communication team. It's not people on our sales team or marketing or research. We have a team that across the globe looks at all verifications individually, and that's all they do. And that's really just to keep, you know, any sort of like personal values from anyone else in the company off these decisions, and to really keep it agnostic globally. So those are the six categories we're looking at. And then within those, I mean, this team looks at those and just assesses, you know, how can we confirm that this person is who they say they are? So, you know, do they have an email address that aligns to a major news organization or a police department or a political party? You know, there's also just some mechanical things to do with an account. Do they have a profile photo? Do they have a banner photo? Do they have an email address that they can confirm? Or if they don't, do they have a phone number they can confirm? So there are some things in the back end that are requirements to be verified too.
To wrap things up, just so everybody's clear, because obviously it's morphed into people just want to get verified and think it's some kind of validity to themselves. Just can you make it clear to everybody the point of verification, the importance, and why the actual tool is there? And that then would obviously, you know, justify why it's so important for these policies to change and what you guys are doing actively to ensure a safe and good, healthy conversation platform for all.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're trying to be like very self-aware about this, how we haven't been clear over the years what it takes to be verified as the platforms change and just online culture. So, I mean, the way I see it and the way we see it as a company is really that mark, that blue tick is really less about that account in some ways. It's really more for the people that might follow that account, just so they know that when they're getting information and they're getting content from that account, you know, and this can be whether they like it or they don't, certainly for someone, you know, presenting opinion that they might not agree with, but they do know that it's this individual giving that content. And then, you know, sometimes there's like other ways where you can, you know, in the literal sense, you know, verify this is probably who I think it is, in terms of, are there other people in your network who follow this account or engaging? But, you know, seeing that blue tick means that Twitter has verified in the back end, yes, this person is who they say they are, or yes, this brand is who they say they are, or this media organization. And you can go from there. You know, that's the source that it's saying who it is.
Well, listen, we so appreciate you breaking down the verification process on Twitter. And of course, if people want more information, they can head to Twitter and follow @verified. Cam, thanks for making this conversation easy to understand. And we will see you online.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
Stay with us. Socially Speaking is next. Amber is going to try and explain Bill C-10. That is no mean feat. And try to make sense of all of the months and months of confusion.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. Socially Speaking.
It's time now for Socially Speaking. And this week we are going to talk about a piece of legislation called Bill C-10 that was first introduced in November of 2020. Now, the bill aims to essentially update the Broadcasting Act in Canada. So the body that essentially regulates broadcasters, the CRTC, would have modern regulations in place to be able to basically ensure that some large tech companies like Netflix would be contributing to Canadian content creation to support the economy, as well as making Canadian content more discoverable. Now, that's a pretty straightforward thing, but in 6 months, as you guys know.
I was going to say, even just that, sorry, I just want to jump in there. Just like, they're already doing that, and they've already announced it, and they're putting like tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars into the Canadian ecosystem already. So I guess, like, is it just because they want at least somewhere in writing, they have to have a minimum somewhere, and it's a government requirement, and that's because in case they then access some tax credits and kickbacks?
So I sort of hate my life right now because I'm learning too much about this and it's all consuming. But when you say that Netflix is already contributing to the Canadian economy, yes, absolutely. Like Hollywood, they're making
millions
shows
of dollars.
But just hold on a sec. The CRTC, this is about CanCon, about telling Canadian stories and Canadian culture. So they do not contribute to that. So you're right. They come in, they make movies and shows, mostly
fair,
American.
Not specifically about Canadian culture.
Exactly.
Or Canadian stories, which obviously is mandated for all broadcasters within Canada. Okay.
Exactly. This is common around the world, right? Like, yep. I don't know, in Australia, you probably
same happened
same
in Australia. Yeah, we have a lot of where you have to do Australian content, and then you also get access to certain ability with tax credits and funding and all kinds of stuff. But obviously, international productions come in all of the time, and they, you know, try and do as much of their content, not specifically anything to do with Australia, specifically from a cultural perspective.
Exactly. So that's the question. So it used to be that television broadcasters, I got my first job on G4 Tech TV, which was a cable TV network that would only existed, quite frankly, as far as my show, a daily 1 hour show because of CanCon. So I'm grateful that we do have those rules in place. But clearly in the broadcast space, as both of you know, it's becoming less, I don't want to say important, but the role has been diminished in light of how much content is being created online. So they're trying to modernize the Broadcasting Act. Now, in theory, that sounds like a good idea because it would be great if we had more opportunities to tell Canadian stories about culture, Indigenous voices. You know, I could go on and on and on. But unfortunately, the bill is written in a way where it is exceptionally confusing, and some of the people explaining it are confusing things even further.
So what are the top two or three things that are being, miscommunicated and are making it confusing?
Well, from my perspective, I think one of the biggest things that has led to this confusion is that there was a clause, a section of the bill that was written into it at the beginning that said that this bill does not apply to user-generated content. Now, that's a terrible term because, it's very vague, right? But it was good that they...
Like people posting on social media channels that are just everyday people. I could be like a 20-year-old in Saskatoon in Canada, or I could be in Halifax and I'm just posting like TikTok videos or something. So,
yeah, and it's good that they had that in there because, it just allowed people to know that that was not the intention of the bill. They took it out because there was part of the bill, I believe it's section 9, where they sort of explain the limitations of the CRTC and that it is not meant to oversee users, but broadcasters. But then you have to ask yourself the question, what is a broadcaster?
What is a broadcaster?
Right?
How do you define a broadcaster?
How do you define this stuff in the digital age? And you know, Aaron, I'm going to actually ask you a super quick question because, even at SiriusXM Canada, if you think about it, you're a broadcaster, but you are also in the podcasting space. So would you agree that it's become increasingly difficult to define what exactly companies do in this world?
It is. That's correct. It is difficult. And I'm hesitant to say what I'm about to say in case the CRTC is listening and didn't know about this loophole, but I'm going to say it anyways. Even with SiriusXM Canada, the SiriusXM you get in your car in Dash is regulated by the CRTC, but SiriusXM online is not. So anything that's streaming off the satellite is regulated, and anything that's streaming over the internet into your smart home speaker or your iOS device or Android device or smart TV streaming device is actually unregulated. So there's more channels and more content. So we kind of have a foot in both camps, but we are putting Canadian content in the unregulated sphere. But does it count for anything if it's unregulated and the CRTC doesn't even know we're doing it because it's the unregulated sphere?
Well, so what it sounds like is, so what it sounds like then is that obviously there has to be some kind of definition of what a broadcaster is, and then that would resolve this. Because obviously, I personally am not a broadcaster, but I make content and I push it across my social channels. But if I then go and create an online media hub and I'm getting paid and I build an audience or whatever that is, there has to be some definition that would then be, in the online space at least, a broadcaster. Obviously, broadcasting is different mediums, radio, TV, film, whatever it is, whether it's online or on traditional channels. So I guess that's, they just need to be, they need to clarify their definition. So obviously people don't go bananas about thinking that that means, you know, your kid's Instagram channel is now regulated, which that's not what they're saying.
It's not what they're saying. And so there's a few things that are taking place. One is the whole conversation about Bill C-10 has become largely political.
The
conservative government has taken it and said, the liberal government is trying to shut down your freedom of expression. They say free speech, but that's an American term. They should probably use the Canadian term. This is leading to people thinking that this bill and the intention of this bill was much more extreme than it actually is. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't do more work on it and have some rewrites and revisit it. But what I'm basically saying is that there's a lot of misinformation. I would like to tell people who are listening as we wrap up that you should read more about it, but it will take you days to understand all of the layers of what's happening. And this is by no means the end of this conversation. So we will pick it up again and let us know what you think on social media. You can tweet at us at Amber Mac and at mbancroft80.
And of course, use the hashtag TheFeed and head on over to ambermac.com for Amber's blog post on this specific topic. This is The Feed with Amber Mac and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks, channel 167.